Right. And this means a continuing tie with the university and a place to come back to the Union, where he spent his leisure hours for all time. And just this one letter produces five memberships, which are now $35 for students.
For students.
Produces life memberships from about one out of 8 or 10 students, and it's a very substantial source of income for us. But it also does some other things in terms of who may use the building, who gets the benefits of this building, which is quite a different story, and I think we better save for another phase of the interview, because it's been an important factor in how we operate and how the regents have decided upon Union building usage. Well, during this campaign, headed now by Ned Gardner, from about 1921 to 23, I think it was, there was not much help from anybody except the Memorial Union Building Committee itself. The university administration had changed. President Burge was now president. He was a scientist, as you know. Whether this ever got through to him as a priority item really is a little hard to say. He's quoted as saying in this campaign brochure, the Memorial Union is at once the university's greatest challenge and greatest opportunity. But words like this were written by Gardner and sent to him to see if he would okay them for usage. In other words, Burge and I think it's fair to say most of his successors were with us on ceremonial occasions and willing to sign endorsements and so on, but there was no thrust or push by the university administration as represented by the president or other leading university administrators to see that this project succeeded. Nor was there any help really from the Alumni Association. It was a weak association. As I think I mentioned earlier, they had maybe 2,500 members altogether, although we had, in the early 20s, we already had more than 90,000 students who attended the university. And the secretary at that time was I guess you'd have to say rather self-centered and weak. He was interested only in something that did something for the Alumni Association and looked on this fundraising for the Union as a kind of a competitive enterprise when he was trying to get members for the Alumni Association.
Who was that?
Pardon?
Who was that?
I'll come back to it.
That's okay.
I'll come back to it. It was a, so this accounted for the absence of any lists of alumni in a given town that Gardner could talk with. It accounted for great dismay on the part of the Memorial Union Building Committee and its own and the former presidents of the Alumni Association that there were no such lists, which in turn led to the creation of the Alumni Records Office, which is where I came into the picture to organize it then. and so on. All this despite the fact that it was publicly announced that the alumni offices would be headquartered in the Union, and that many of the services of the building, like guest rooms and meeting rooms and so on, were designed especially for alumni. But it ended up that Gardner frequently told me with no real help, in fact often obstruction by the alumni administrative secretary. There was, however, a continuing effort personally by Walter Kohler. He became the vice chairman of the Memorial Union Building Committee himself. Fred Clausen of Hart and a former president of the Alumni Association was named chairman, but to show his support and continuing interest, he accepted the vice chairmanship. And I believe it may well have been due to him as much as anyone that the union became the recipient of part of the J. Stevens Tripp estate. It was in the Tripp will that his whole estate would be given to the University of Wisconsin. It was very substantial for that time, something like $500,000. And I think it must have been Kohler who saw to it that $200,000 of this estate was allocated to the Memorial Union Fund. And this accounts for the naming of the Tripp Commons Dining Hall in the Union. Another $200,000 was allocated to the dormitories, to the construction of men's dormitories, and accounts for the naming of Tripp Hall. Well, this was a wearing, fatiguing, health-shattering job for Gardner, and he finally had to give it up. Shortly before he gave it up, he called back as an assistant, John Dollard, class of 22 graduate in commerce, who Gardner had had as a student, and thought well of him. And he was indeed a very bright young man. And he was out on the road in the state selling evening correspondence courses. When Gardner approached him about coming back to assist with the campaign, and Dollard came in about 1923, late 1923, I believe it was. And then Gardner went back to teaching and was in poor health for some time. Dollard took a new approach to the campaign in terms of particularly of bringing the campaign back to the campus with a focus on what students could do and what the faculty could do to achieve this building and through fundraising. And he set forth to meet with the student leaders of the time, with members of the Aaron Cross Society, which was the Senior Men's Honor Society, with the Women on Mortarboard, the top senior women's group, all named to these groups because of their places of leadership on the campus, and of course with the Men's Union Board itself and any and all other students, class presidents, and so forth. And he'd have constant sessions with them, frequently in his own apartment, telling the story of what, or renewing the story of what the union was about, what it might be. It was the intervention of the war and taking of the campaign out to nationwide cities, some of the momentum and knowledge by students of what the union offered probably had got lost along the way, although not entirely. For example, Frederick March, who was president of the class of 1920, organized the first class campaign on behalf of the union. So shortly after the war, the class campaign did continue. But Dollard put it on a different basis, and that was not just senior class campaign, not just special events, but personal giving, and managed to organize house-to-house campaigns in which students rang each other's doorbells to solicit what? Life memberships in the union at a student rate of $50. And every fraternity and sorority was asked to pledge 100%, that is 100% of their members. And there were great visible demonstrations of during these campaigns, such as every time another $1,000 was raised, a cannon would be fired off at the lower campus, announcing this in a big thermometer chart.
Oh, no.
Well, if this cannon boomed, the thermometer chart would go up another in red paint, another $1,000 would be added. The library didn't like this very much because they thought the cannon roaring every few minutes disturbed the study in the study hall and in the corral. But it wasn't all that serious or difficult. Anyhow, there was a great resurgence of interest by students in personal leadership of the campaign, and due, I think, primarily to Dollard's inspiration and leadership. However, he also worked closely with key faculty members, and particularly with Professor Max Mason. He enlisted his interest, and Max Mason was the key advisor to President Byrd at that time. And you may remember that Mason was a very notable person because he invented the submarine detector, which had had much to do with the defeat of the German submarine force, and many ascribed to the submarine detector one of the main reasons why the United States won the war, at least against the submarine.
Is that so?
He was a person of very great influence and prestige in the administration and among the faculty, too. And Mason, in turn, enlisted Dr. Harold Bradley in an interest in this project. This would be in about 1924-25. Dr. Bradley, having seven sons himself, was interested in young people and had, as much as any faculty member, a way with students, his own advisees and students generally. And through Mason and Bradley, Dollard managed to get appointed a faculty committee on student social needs. and he himself became secretary of it, and Dr. Bradley became chairman. This committee went to work on two fronts, namely what did students need by way of a union. Well, I should put it another way, what did students need other than classroom instruction? And the answer was they needed a social and service center, recreation center, which they readily identified as the union, and they needed housing, dormitory housing, there being yet no dormitories on the campus. And this again was part of Van Hise's inaugural appeal that there be residence halls, as there were at Oxford and Cambridge. The union wasn't the only thing he appealed for. He appealed strongly for residence halls too. So they proceeded to investigate what others were doing about union development and residence halls development, and Dollard made the trips to inspect what unions there were, and there weren't very many, mainly Michigan that had just got open, a very substantial large building in Harthouse at Toronto, and made extensive inquiries about residence halls and so on, and wrote the report that urged the immediate construction of the Memorial Union and of residence hall. Dr. Bradley and Mason, with their influence with the administration, saw to it that these two projects became high priority items in the administration. Well, this was at about the time that President Burge was to retire, 1925. And this leads us to the incident that I started to mention the other day. The heir apparent to Burge was Max Mason. The faculty almost unanimously believed he would be the next president, wanted him to be. He was very popular among students, and students saw in Mason a supporter for their prime enterprises, like the union, like the residence hall, and so on. And the president of the class of 1925, John Bergstresser by name.
What was that? John?
John Bergstresser, who was also from Springfield, Illinois, by the way. I brought him here as the year following I came as a freshman. He was a roommate of mine, and he succeeded me in the alumni records office when I moved over to the union. But as a student, he was elected president of the class of 25. And he, with the leadership of the Iron Cross Society and Mortar Board, got a petition urging the appointment of Max Mason as president of the university, succeeding President Burge, signed by some 4,500 students out of an enrollment of, I think at that time, not more than 8,000, a very substantial outpouring of student endorsement for their hoped for new president. And Bergstresser was the one who was to carry this petition to the regents. We were in the process of search and screen to find a successor for Burge. And the meetings with the regents were postponed, and next time, and so on, and so on. Finally, the appointment came through, and Bergstresser sat in the waiting room outside the regent meeting, petition in hand, evidence of student approval for and support for Max Mason, ready to go in and make the pitch. And the secretary of the regents came out to scene and said, well, you can come in now, but I perhaps should tell you that the Regents had just appointed Glenn Frank as president of the university.
Oh, dear.
So he never got a chance to make his case on behalf of students. Whether, if he'd made it, it would have changed anything, one can't know, of course. But it illustrates, of course, a major turning point in the whole university history when the Regents, and largely, I think, through Zona Gale's influence, who knew Glenn Frank as the editor of the Century magazine, wasn't it?
Yes.
And thought well of his progressive notions about education. He received the bid, and he came on as president. Well, this was a vast disappointment to students. They felt let down over this.
So.
And, of course, Mason, obviously, was disappointed because this was his alma mater and where he'd achieved his professional reputation. But he had his other bids in hand already and was shortly elected president by the University of Chicago. And in going there, as I mentioned the other day, asked Dollard to go with him as assistant to the president, which opened the door for me to come in on fundraising for the union. This might have happened anyhow. If Mason had become president in Wisconsin, he may very well have commanded Dollar to take an administrative position on the Hill in another role. But in any event, this turn of events resulted in my appearance as Dollar's successor, as secretary of the Memorial Union Building Committee and fundraiser. Well, the university administration nevertheless, by way of whether Burge or Frank or whoever, paid attention to this faculty committee report and did put a high priority on the construction of both dormitories in the union. And we were, by this time, about reaching the point where the funds were sufficient to build at least the first two units of the building, not the theater wing. And the decision was made to get this much done in any event, because there was a good deal of strain and concern about the campaign had gone since 1919, it was now 1925, and nobody could see the building that they'd given their money for, and it was a great deterrent to further fundraising because people began to feel this thing never going to happen. So Dollard, before he left for Chicago, this was in 1925 again, persuaded the university to let a contract for excavation. And they did clear the site, they dug the hole to receive the building. And there was a tremendous sign out on the site saying, let's dig. And in the Daily Cardinal, the banner headline was, let's dig, and a big page that occupied two-thirds of the page of the front page of the Cardinal was there, and this was all to get additional monies in and show that progress was going to be made, and if enough money came in, we'd go ahead and build the building. And there was this great student effort of 1925, general campus-wide campaign, and again in 26 and so on, which resulted in what I've told you about, an outpouring of student giving. Well, the time came when the building plans were put out for bid, and bids came in some $90,000 over the funds available.
Ooh.
And at this time in the state's history, there was no such thing as funding a building through borrowing. But the state constitution read then, as it did for years after, that the state may contract no debt except during civil war or civil disturbance, and not to exceed $50,000 for even that. So borrowing was not possible on the part of the university or part of the state. So what's to do? What to do? The Regents looked at these bids, $90,000 short, were not too unhappy about it, because the low bidder was a non-union contractor from Duluth. And under state law, they would have had to award the contract to the low bidder. They had no choice. The second low bidder was a union contractor from Janesville.
Mm-hmm.
And he was $15,000 over the low bidder. The Regents, and this is the same Regent group that elected Frank as president, because of his progressive leanings. It was a progressive Board of Regents, progressive party Board of Regents, under the aegis and appointment of the Blaine, Governor Blaine La Follette Progressive Party, which was very strong in the state at that time, and virtually all the Regents were progressive party appointees. And they did not want to see a contract go to a non-union contractor. So they were not unhappy about this outcome, and notified Dollard in the Union Building Committee that the project could not go ahead unless the full cash required, namely another $90,000, was in hand by the deadline, which was some week or 10 days later. Well, during that week, there came a visit from the Janesville contractor, who was second low bidder, but $15,000 over the low bidder, came a visit to Dollard by him. And Dollard called me into the office. We sat there together while this chap, this contractor, said, "I've always been interested in this union project, and I'd like to make a contribution of about $15,000.
Oh, that's lovely.
And the implication, of course, was that if we could manage, if we could just set about to persuade the Regents to take the second low bid, we wouldn't lose any money, they wouldn't lose any money because he would have made his gift. Dollard looked at him and said, "Well, I'm interested in what you say. Where I come from, this sounds like a bribe. I will be glad to report this to the Board of Regents that we've been offered a bribe of $15,000 to help you get this contract." So the contractor, considerably flustered, got up and walked out of the office. That was the first incident. The second was that George Haight, bless his heart, he was co-chairman of the fundraising committee, swung into action and persuaded Louis Hanks, the president of the First Wisconsin, now called First Wisconsin Bank, First National Bank then, to loan the Memorial Union Building Committee $90,000 if guaranteed by 9 alumni at $10,000 each, and on a personal signature basis, and Hanks agreed to this. And Haight got on the telephone, mainly to other members of the Memorial Union Building Committee, and got eight
to agree
to sign this note, personal guarantee payment. Then he had to leave for New York on a law case. He was a Chicago man with the ninth man still missing. On the train coming back from New York the day before the Regents meeting that was to settle this, he'd been looking for Carl Johnson, the president of the Gisors. Coming back on the train in the same parlor car sitting across from me was Carl Johnson.
Oh, my.
So Haight made his appeal to Johnson. Johnson readily agreed, and the next morning they had at the bank the signatures of nine men on a $90,000 note and a check for $90,000 from the First National Bank, which was delivered to Dollard on a Thursday. And the next morning he walked into the Regents meeting, the Regents expecting to tell him that the project is off. And Dollard said, "Well, gentlemen, we now have the $90,000 and produced the check. And the Regents were not happy about this. It was one of those political things that sometimes characterizes state and university business. But the contract was let, and the contractor came on the job.
Well, this was let to the low bidder, not
the
man
had,
from
had to be, under the law, it had to be given to the low bidder. This did not end our troubles with the labor unions. It was the beginning of very serious troubles, which if you read some of the union literature, you know what they were like. They picketed the building site, although the non-union contractor was willing and able, glad to hire Madison. Laborers, he insisted only on having his own supervisors and superintendents for each trade, but he would take anyone else from the Madison labor market. That didn't satisfy the local Madison labor unions. They wanted to strike the job and they pull everybody off. So there was this picket line thrown around the building, and the contractor couldn't get anyone on the job to do the work. Well, he was under contract now to build the building and by a certain time. So to meet his obligation, he imported laborers from elsewhere after making all his offers to Madison laborers. And since they couldn't get through the picket line, he built a shanty. A wooden dormitory out here on the lakeshore behind the building and housed them here on the site in order to have them available to go to work the next morning.
My word.
They were housed and fed here by the lakeshore. Well, the time came one night when I was in the Union Annex, which was President Burge's old home, the president's old home, where
the
theater
corner
now is.
Mm-hmm.
That was our temporary fundraising headquarters while this site was being developed with a new building. I was sitting there along working from around 11 o'clock at night, which wasn't unusual because this was a high-pressure thing. He had a lot of things to do, and evening work was part of it. I heard this rumble and commotion outside and looked out the window, and here were something like 150 or 200 men with clubs marching down Park Street toward the lake and aiming for this shack where the contractors' workmen were housed. So I could tell there was trouble, and I called the police frantically to tell them what was up. They couldn't have been less interested.
Okay.
They knew all about it, of course. They were unionized themselves and friends of the labor union people who were marching on the site, and apparently aware of what was happening, but not interested in interference. Despite the frantic pleas I was making that there would be trouble, and there was. They destroyed the shanty, they broke a few bones, they threw these men in the lake, they threw bottles of ink all over the masonry that had gone up by this time, and it was a real fiasco. Well, this made the headlines for quite a few days, and the Attorney General, who was the lawyer for the university, was able to point out to the mayor of Madison that when police did not respond to a legitimate call for protection, that he, the mayor, was personally responsible for any damage done in the absence of police protection.
Mm-hmm.
So right away we got police protection, and the police and the picket line disappeared. But that's a long and involved story, but it indicates part of the problems the union had in getting born. Well, as you can see, we're in the year 1926 when I was had now become the secretary of the building committee, fundraising group. And it was no longer just fundraising because the building was going up. And by the way, the reason the cornerstone reads 1925 is because that's when that hole was dug in the ground.
I see.
And it was indeed the start of construction. But as you know, the building itself wasn't completed and didn't open until 1928. Well, in the period of 1926 to 1928, we had all the other corollaries of getting the building furnished and equipped, of deciding what kind of organization would operate the union, and what kind of programs would be undertaken within it, what the student role would be, what the administration connection with university administration connection with the union would be, and all the rest.
Before you go on to that, I have a question. I was wondering who drew up the building plans?
Building plans were first done under commission by the Memorial Union Building Committee by Eschweiler and Eschweiler at Milwaukee. And for some strange lack of communication that I don't understand, because this was, and I was not yet here, it was overlooked that the state law required that the state architect do all the plans for state buildings of whatever kind. I think the Memorial Union Building Committee felt that this was not a state building, it was a gift building, that they were presenting a completed building to the university, drawn, built, presented. But the interpretation of the capital was that not so, the blueprints, the plans themselves, must be the work of the state architect, as with all other state buildings. This was back in the days where there weren't all that many state buildings being designed, and so a small drafting staff and architectural staff at the Capitol could do it. Well, the state architect was Arthur Peabody, and he, after quite a hassle and dispute and paying off Eschweiler and Eschweiler with for a fee for their work, it got turned over to the state architect, and it went through all sorts of modifications and changes before the final set of plans was put out for bid. But the story of what facilities were included and why, and how the building physical plan has evolved is really another story, because it's a harrowing story in some respects, and a continuing story of both development and disappointment, which if you're interested, we could go into it
on another
occasion, because we're still at the point where we're discussing getting ready to open a building, and what was required in order to do that. I mentioned the necessity of providing furniture and equipment. The building contract for the structure had been let, and it used all the monies available. There was no money for equipment or furnishings, and this included light fixtures, elevators, as well as the room furniture, desks and tables and chairs in the dining units and so on.
I suppose kitchen equipment.
And so the next question was, where do we get $400,000 for that purpose, which was the estimate of what it would require. And we just about used up our potential in fundraising among students and alumni. And so it was at this point that Theodore Cronsage, who was now president of the Regents, and George Haight, and I think Phil LaFollette, attorney in town, he was not yet a political figure, but he was a former union board member, by the way, in 1919, or thereabouts, 1918. They got their legal heads together and devised an approach which involved the creation of the Wisconsin University Building Corporation, which would rent the building structure from the university for $1 a year, on the agreement to completely furnish and equip it, and then would lease it back to the university at an annual rental sufficient to cover the mortgage payments on the $400,000. It was a lease, what was called a leaseback arrangement. And all these documents were shaped up, and the building corporation was formed, included university officers primarily, and the building corporation was given a lease on the building, did borrow the $400,000, and used that to buy equipment, furnishings, and completed the building.
I leased the finished building back to the university at a rental of $36,000 a year, which was the sum required to amortize the $400,000 mortgage in 15 years. Well, this was a salvation for the union. It was also the salvation for the men's residence halls, which also had to find money to get built. They did not have either state appropriations or any general fundraising. They had $200,000 from the Tripp estate, and that was all. So both these institutions happened by way of the creation of the Wisconsin University Building Corporation.
They did the same thing with the dormitory.
Pardon?
The corporation did a similar arrangement with the dormitory?
Yes. Yes, they did both. They did the financing of both. But since the loan of $400,000 to the building corporation was made from the state teachers' retirement fund, pension funds.
Mm-hmm.
The state teachers' retirement officers instituted a friendly suit to determine whether this was legal or not, whether this was indeed a state debt, which was prohibited by the Constitution, or whether it was legitimate. So we went through a long period of court review, which ended up with a Supreme Court decision that it was legal, did not constitute a state debt, and this satisfied the State Teachers Retirement Board. It was a crucial key decision because it led on to this method of financing for all sorts of university buildings, and through borrowing by the Wisconsin University Building Corporation. And indeed the state itself adopted this method.
Oh, that's nice.
For financing new state buildings. Prior to this time, any state building that was built had to have a specific legislative appropriation in tax dollars before a contract could be let. And this meant that an unwilling legislature, unwilling to raise taxes for this kind of purpose, would not approve new state buildings, and so there was a great drought in state building for any purpose all through the 20s and the 30s, and until this device of the building corporation became legitimatized and workable. And this continued as the prime method of state construction financing until the Constitution was amended in just very recent years, permitting state, direct state debt, full faith and credit of the state behind its borrowing. So this is something I think we've always considered the union enterprise contributed to state welfare that otherwise might never have happened.
That is an interesting.
Now, as to how to get ready to operate and how to operate and for whom, and we're talking about the period of now of 1927, when this equipment and furniture financing plan was resolved. Up to this time, the concept of a union was primarily that of a men's club building, with provisions for some dining,
lounges, newspapers, game tables, like billiards, and meeting rooms. And this derived from the earliest unions, those in Britain, starting with Oxford and Cambridge in about 1815, 1820. Where they were indeed patterned after the British Gentlemen's Club. Every British person of parts belonged to some club. You're familiar with the British cultural tradition.
Yes.
The British Club was quite an institution. Well, so were the Oxford and Cambridge unions, patterned after these, but with their special emphasis on debate and discussion, which I won't go into now because that's a whole different story, but had an important bearing on what the Oxford and Cambridge unions were like. They had had very large debate halls, for example, and as I mentioned in connection with Van Hise's appeal for a union at Wisconsin, through debate and discussion and student leadership, they became known as the cradle of the British Parliament. Trained students deliberately for leadership of the British Commonwealth. Well, different from Oxford and Cambridge were the early unions in the United States and Canada, in that they did not deal much with debate and discussion, except at Harthouse, the Canadian Union. Rather, they were oriented more toward the men's club concept for social, dining, and recreation purposes, but also including, as with Michigan and Purdue and Indiana and several others, very substantial hotel units to accommodate returning alumni. But primarily throughout for men. The Michigan Union, as we knew it then and up until not a time not too long ago, there was a uniformed attendant at the front door to refer women to the side door at the Michigan Union, and they were eligible to use only certain facilities of the Michigan Union. Well, the Michigan Union was the prime example in the 20s of what a union was, and in this early exploration in the early 1920s, much of what we cranked into the building plans here, I say we, it wasn't myself, it was my predecessors, borrowing on Michigan Union, they put in on Trip Commons, a men's boarding hall, such as they had at Michigan, and a tap room, we called it a Rotskeller, and game rooms, billiards, pocket billiards, and so on, and some hotel rooms, not many, but some, and food services, generally, meeting rooms, and so on. And the facilities for women were, in the blueprints, fairly limited. They consisted of a women's parlor on the second floor off the Great Hall, which was a ballroom and where women were expected if you were going to have dancing. And in the cafeteria, women were expected, but not in the Rotskeller, not in the game rooms, not in the library, all right in the meeting rooms, and so on. And this was exemplified partly by the fact that there was just really one women's washroom in the building, in this parlor near the ballroom. So we were born as a men's club too, but we rapidly changed this and changed it before the building opened. And for two or three reasons. You want me to go into those?
Yes, I'd be very interested.
For one thing, the women students did better in fundraising for the union than the men did.
They did.
They personally gave money in greater numbers in proportion to their numbers. And they were the more active, eager workers. This was one reason for the change. Another reason for the change was the pressure from the women themselves. Now, in the beginning, it didn't sound too bad to have a men's club emphasis because the women already had a women's club in Lathrop Hall and had it for years. Lathrop parlors, social meeting rooms, a tea room, offices for Women's Self-Government Association, staff members to help, meeting rooms, the works. This was thought of as the women's union. It wasn't called a union, called Lathrop Hall, but it was indeed a women's club center. Well, the Dean of Women, Louise Narden, was also housed in Lathrop Hall, and she wanted it there, and she wanted the girls there under her supervisory eye, and for reasons of rapport with the student leadership and easy access back and forth for communication, and for, I suppose, purposes of better being able to assert the dean's influence in what women did and how they did it. So she didn't want the women to be included too much in the union. And in the earlier days, the women recognized they had a club center of their own and that the men ought to have one too, like theirs. But once they saw the building going up and with the changes of student personnel and so on, they decided they'd rather be over here where the men were. And as far as the men were concerned, I think they preferred to have the women over here too. But not in all parts of the building. The Rotskeller and the game rooms were still considered sacrosanct for men. And so when the building opened, what happened was that the dining was opened up generally to women, all the meeting rooms, all the student offices were here, Cardinal, Badger, drama clubs and so on that women fully participated in. And Great Hall was developed as a general women's lounge, except for weekends when dances occurred and occasional banquets. Carpets on the floor, lounging furniture, tea service every afternoon, and women's magazines available, and a hostess on the job, and so on. This in addition to Lathrop Hall, which was still going on because the dean wanted it to go on. But we paid the bill at Lathrop Hall from here on, too. The union did. They paid for the staff hostess secretary over there and for the periodicals and for the social program that took place at Lathrop.
Why was that?
Well, because all women, as well as men, now paid a union fee. A fee to belong to the union as part of their registration fee. Part of their incidental fee when they enrolled. So this was $10 a year, $5 a semester. And women paid it as well as men. So we were sure that we had to and wanted to provide equal services for women as well as men. So as long as they maintained Lathrop club rooms, we underwrote those financially, both staff and supplies and all the rest, as well as creating a great hall as a women's floor. That's where the women's fathers
worship. You looked on Lathrop Hall then as a kind of extension of the
union.
Yeah,
it was a kind of a satellite union, but for women only. Then the ground floor of this building, the Rockefeller and game rooms, were exclusively for men. And the middle floor, the main lounge and the gallery, were for both. So a kind of a Middlesex room where they could come together. And of course they came together at dances and meetings. Other social affairs. This was a first major departure from the men's club concept. Also, following Van Hise's appeal for informal student-faculty relationships, that much of what students learn, they learn from faculty outside the classroom. We wanted to involve faculty to the maximum, as indeed the Oxford and Cambridge unions had. They extended membership in Oxford-Cambridge unions to the faculty as well as to students. And then because of our history as a fundraising, because of our history and fundraising of extending life memberships to alumni, alumni were considered one of our prime constituencies, and taken all together, we saw the union as a center for all who were associated with the university, students, faculty, alumni.